hospital managers proved to be particularly devious. When they were set targets to cut waiting lists, they ordered consultants to do the easiest operations first, like bunions and mastectomies. Complicated ones, like cancers, were no longer prioritised. And they found other clever ways of getting people off the lists.
What happened at this hospital is truly shocking. Administrators wrote to patients asking them when they'd be on holiday. They then used that information to set the timing of the operation, knowing that the patients would be away. As a result, the patients did not get their operations, but the hospital managed to cut its waiting lists.
And when the managers were set a target to reduce waiting times in casualty, they came up with more clever strategies. A new job was invented, called the hello nurse, who did nothing to treat the patient, but simply greeting them meant they had been seen and were off the list. When the government then tried to set a target to reduce the number of patients waiting on trolleys, the managers took the wheels off the trolleys and reclassified them as beds. And they redefined the corridors as walls. And yet again, the patients were off the list. The police were also under pressure to meet their targets. One of the main ones was to reduce the rate of recorded crime. Again, inventive strategies were found. Lothian police announced the most successful crime figures in 25 years. But it was later found that they had reclassified hundreds of crimes, including assault, robbery and fire-raising, as simply suspicious occurrences, which wouldn't be included in the figures.
We are passionate about meeting these targets.
Fiddling.
By the management.
Altered their records.
But that's a bit odd. I mean, you're the consultant.
And started to amend some of the answers that the youngsters had given.
Trolley weights, none.
Targets. Three levels of targets.
Clear targets, targets, those targets. And focus on those targets. Why are they targets? Targets.
The government tried to dismiss these reports as just a few bad examples. But report after report came out, which revealed that this inventive gaming of the system was now endemic throughout the public services. What was supposed to be a rational system was instead creating a strange world in which no one knew whether to believe the numbers or not. The government's response was to introduce even more mathematical levels of management. Complex systems of auditing were created to monitor workers and make sure they fulfilled the targets in the correct way. What had begun as a system of liberation was turning into a powerful system of control.
If I don't hit those targets, then I don't get a pay increase. It's as simple as that.
They withhold your increment?
They withhold my increment.
Not meeting the targets is really not an option.
It's such an important target that I get to keep my job this month because there's no red on the screen.
If they don't reach the targets, they're axed, and if they speak out against them, they're axed. We here have a catch-22 situation.
If you get zero-star rated, you are being watched like a hawk.
So, I think you should go.
But the numbers were also having a strange and perverse effect on New Labour's vision of a freer and more open Britain. They were, in fact, creating a more rigid and stratified society. At the heart of this was education and the league tables for schools. The tables showed parents which were the best-performing schools and which were the worst ones. The government said that this would incentivise the less successful ones to compete and improve their services, and standards would then rise across the country. In fact, the very opposite happened. Rich parents moved into the areas of the best schools, which then caused house prices to spiral, keeping the poor out. And nearly all schools taught their pupils only those narrow facts they would need to answer in exams, and so would help the schools rise up the league tables. What was lost was the wider education that would help the poorer children rise up in society. In 2006, a series of reports made it clear that there was a definite link between the government's policies in education and the rise of social segregation based on wealth. This has contributed to a much wider problem. Social mobility in Britain has now ground to a halt. The stark fact is that the children of rich families in Britain today are much more likely to live and die rich than in the recent past, while children from poor families are more likely to live and die poor. the country has become more rigid and stratified than at any time since the Second World War. New Labour had adopted the market model of freedom, believing that there would be a trade-off. They gave up their old political role of intervening in the market to reduce inequality, but what was supposed to follow was a new openness and fluidity in society. In fact, they now have the worst of both worlds. Society has become more rigid, while the inequalities have become more extreme. Under New Labour, the country is even more unequal than it was under Mrs. Thatcher, with an ever-increasing share of the wealth going to a tiny 1% at the top of society. And the inequalities not only affect how you live, but also when you will die. Across the country, differences in life expectancy have increased since 1997. And inequalities in child mortality by class have also increased. A baby born in Hackney is now twice as likely to die in its first year as a baby born in Bexley. Beneath the meritocratic surface, the social class divisions in Britain are hardening and deepening. And in America, throughout the 1990s, the economic model of democracy was leading not just to the rise of inequality, but to financial and political corruption on a huge scale. America had experienced a spectacular market boom, but those running the market had realised that the numbers were not telling the truth because the giant accounting firms had become corrupted.
There was a new element afoot. The very foundation of the market, the numbers that represented the sanctity of the market, the reliability of the market, were becoming unreliable because the accountants had violated the trust the government had placed in them.
Arthur Levitt, Chairman, Securities and Exchange Commission, 1993 to 2001.
I knew that the great accounting firms of America had engaged in practices that were very, very questionable and very often fraudulent. We were seeing more and more and more of these cases.
How widespread did it become?
Extremely widespread.
Those who ran many of America's corporations were faking profits on an enormous scale. They did this because it would then increase their personal bonuses.
Itzhak Shirov, professor of accounting, Columbia Business School.
Come on, they would say, isn't there another way of looking at those numbers? Can we compromise? Can we spread, for example, this misrepresentation over a number of years? In all of these cases, the effect is one of corruption. We were trusted. We had a rational system based on numbers that could not be disputed. We ended up now with a fictitious, irrational system.
The officials, whose job was to regulate the market, tried to persuade politicians in Congress to act and expose this, but they were blocked at every turn. They found that all the key politicians were being given millions of dollars in campaign contributions by both the corporations and the accounting firms.
Arthur Levitt.
I mean, massive amounts of money were spent in lobbying committees of Congress. I knew they were motivated by concern for business interests.
You mean they've been bribed?
No. I wouldn't use that word. That's your word.
What word would you use?
Seduced.
Despite the growing evidence of corruption, the Clinton administration portrayed the boom as something revolutionary. It was a genuine democracy of the marketplace in which everyone at all levels of society was benefiting. But this was completely untrue. If one compares the incomes of Americans in real terms between the end of the 1970s and the end of the 1990s, those at the bottom of society saw their income actually fall. Those in the middle saw a slight increase, while those at the top increased by an extraordinary amount.
Kevin Phillips, political analyst.
If you take income after taxes, you find that the average household cash income in the bottom fifth of Americans went from $9,300 a year to $8,700. You find that the average household cash income in the middle fifth, the median, went from about 31,800 to 33,200. You take the top 1% in the same time period, you go from $256,000 a year to $644,000 a year. That, to me, is the simplest set of numbers I can use to sum it all up. I have many variations, but those just eat right out of the box at you. It's just incredible how you can have something like that.
Underlying the political experiments of the 1990s had been a simplified idea of human beings. That at heart they were just self-seeking individuals whose needs could be best met through the marketplace, not politics. If left unregulated, the markets would benefit everyone. In the face of this simple, irresistible argument, politicians had given away much of their power. But what had actually happened was the return of inequalities and social injustices not seen for 100 years. The very thing politicians were supposed to prevent. Politicians now found themselves weakened and corrupted, and without the power to change society. And millions of individuals were left without representation and even less control over their lives.
Robert Reich.
Here is the ultimate irony. Because as people began to believe they are just self-seeking, acquisitive individuals, that the democratic systems are fundamentally not nearly as good as the market for fulfilling whatever it is you want, people allowed elites to take over politics and politics to be distorted and corrupted so that politics became even less capable of fulfilling people's needs. And meanwhile, the market did not give people good jobs, secure jobs. And so ultimately the individual cannot be fulfilled either through politics or through the market.
What had given this simplified view of human beings much of its power had been ideas drawn from both mathematics and biology. As this program has shown, it underpinned a powerful model of ourselves as almost computer-like machines, whose instincts had largely been encoded within them millions of years before. But now, questions were beginning to be asked in the scientific world about whether this was too simple a view of human beings. In genetics, the idea that the DNA is the all-controlling set of instructions for life has been replaced by a more complex idea. Scientists have shown that a cell actually chooses and edits which parts of the DNA to use, depending on the environmental forces acting on it. One of the key experiments that showed that the self-interested actions of genes control behavior has also been questioned. Anthropologists looked into the history of the Yanomami tribes and discovered a pattern to their violence that could be explained by very different causes than genes. It only seemed to happen when the Yanomami came into contact with Westerners who gave them goods. The tribes fought with each other for access to those goods.
Brian Ferguson, anthropologist.
What I discovered was that there was a pattern in which the warfare became more intense or happened at all during times of greater Western penetration into the area. You're not going to get any help by looking at their reproductive striving. I think what will explain that for you is what is the historical interactions with these powerful outside forces. That explains when and where they fight.
And those powerful outside forces are what?
The powerful outside forces are predominantly the Westerners who come in who are sources of these much-desired goods.
Anthropologists have looked again at the film of the axe fight. They argue that what one actually sees is a struggle between two factions. One, a group who have been given machetes by the filmmaker, Napoleon Chagnon. The other, a group of visitors to the village who are refusing to leave because they too want access to these precious gifts. The real cause of the fight, they say, is not the genes, but a struggle of politics and power, aggravated by the filmmaker himself. But Chagnon completely disagrees and stands by his experiment.
No, I don't think the axe fight happened because I was there.
You sure?
Well, are you sure your father's your father? I think it would be a reasonable presumption that this axe fight would have happened whether or not I was there. And the very fact that I was there and documented it was not the cause of it. Because axe fights or club fights happen in many other villages when I'm not there. And I've documented these as well through informants who described them. So I don't think this particular fight was anything extraordinary and out of the pattern of Yanomami violence.
You don't think a film crew in the middle of a fight in a village has an effect?
No, I don't. That's the end of my interview.
And in mathematics, the man who had created the equations that lay behind the simplified economic model of society was also expressing doubts about the assumptions on which his work had been based. He was the mathematician John Nash. Nash, who has now recovered from paranoid schizophrenia and still works at Princeton, has come to believe that the purely rational, calculating creatures in his model, what he calls the human as businessman, have little connection with the complexity of real human beings.
I have had some trouble myself on the psychological level. I've been in mental hospitals, and so I have. I may be developing a pattern of rationality. I realize that what I had said at some time may have overemphasized rationality or some type of thinking, and I don't want to overemphasize rational thinking on the part of humans. Human beings are much more complicated than like the human being as a businessman. Human behavior is not entirely motivated by self-interest of each pure human.
But the underlying assumption of game theory is that it is.
Game theory works in terms of self-interest. But it was like the viewpoint that some game theory concept could be unsound. There's over-dependence on rationality. That is my enlightenment.
And Nash is not alone. In economics, the whole idea that the free market is an efficient system is coming under serious attack. Over the past 5 years, many of the Nobel Prizes for economics have been awarded for research that shows that markets do not create stability or order. That what Adam Smith called the invisible hand is invisible because it isn't actually there. And politicians do have a powerful role to play in controlling the markets. And a new discipline called behavioral economics has been studying whether people really do behave as the simplified model says they do. Their studies show that only two groups in society actually behave in a rational, self-interested way in all experimental situations. One is economists themselves. The other is psychopaths.
Is that all there is?
And you were listening to a video documentary by Adam Curtis, The Trap, What Happened to Our Dream of Freedom, Part 2, The Lonely Robot, adapted by me for radio. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warren Yelton, or WMRW Warren.
More shadow work in the factory, greasy up my clothes. The more shadow work in the factory, splinters in my toes. Pity me, my darling. Pity me, I say, pity me, my darling, and carry me away. The more shall I hear the bosses say, boys, you better doff. No more shall I hear the bosses say, spinners, you better clean off. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. pity me, my darling, and carry me away. Or shall I hear the drummer wheels rolling over my head? When factories are hard at work, I'll be in my bed. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. No more shall I wear the old black dress, greasy all around. No more shall I wear the old black bonnet with holes all in the crown. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. Shall I see the super come all dressed up so proud? For I know I'll marry a country boy when the year is out. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away.
Factory Girl by David Rovics, a song about what it was like to live in Friedrich Hayek's golden age of the free market. We'll conclude the program with the next installment from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, continuing in Chapter 18, Breaking Out of the Trap. Where we left off last week, Gatto said that the edifice of compulsory schooling, and by extension the centralized corporate society it was created to serve, could not be reformed. It would have to be dismantled. His suggestion and prediction that people would begin to opt out and create not only their own schools, but their own economies at the local level. Gatto writes, "We still have to face the propaganda barrier set up by statistical psychology. I mean the scam which demonstrates mathematically that most people don't have the stuff to do it. This is the rocket driving school at breakneck speed across the barren land it traverses as a mobile hospital for the detritus of evolution. Could it be that all the pedagogical scientists have gotten it wrong? Are ordinary people better than they think?" I found a telling clue in Charles Murray's bestseller, The Bell Curve, at the spot when Murray pauses to politely denounce black schoolteacher Marva Collins' fantastic claim that ghetto black children had real enthusiasm for difficult intellectual work. Oddly enough, that was exactly my own experience as a white schoolteacher with black 13-year-olds from Harlem. I was curious why Dr. Murray or Dr. Herrnstein, or both, became so exercised, since Marva Collins otherwise doesn't figure in the book. So certain were the authors that Collins couldn't be telling the truth that they dismissed her data while admitting they hadn't examined the situation firsthand. That is contempt of a very high order, however decorously phrased. The anomaly struck me even as I lay in the idyllic setting of a beach on the northern coast of Oahu, watched over by sea turtles, where I'd gone to do research for this book in America's most far-flung corporate colony, Hawaii. Bell curve theory has been around since Methuselah under different names, just as theories of multiple intelligence have, Why get out of sorts because a woman of color argued from her practice, a dissent? Finally, the light went on. Bell curve mudsill theory loses its credibility if Marva Collins is telling the truth. Trillions of dollars and the whole social order are at stake. Marva Collins has to be lying. Is Marva telling the truth? 30 years of public school teaching whisper to me that she is. George Meagan was 25 years old and an elementary school dropout. A British merchant seaman, when he decided to take the longest walk in human history without any special equipment, foundation bankroll, or backing of any kind. Leaving his ship in South America, he made his way to Tierra del Fuego alone and just began to walk. 7 years later, after crossing the Andes, making his way through the trackless Darien Gap, and after taking a long detour on foot to see Washington, D.C., he arrived at the Arctic Ocean with a wife he met and married along the way, and their two children. In that instant, part of the high academic story of human migrations received its death blow from a dropout. His book was published in 1982. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. About an hour out of Philadelphia, there was once and may still be a large U.S. Air Force base from which officers being sent overseas to Germany, Crete, and elsewhere were transshipped like California cabbages. During the early 1980s, I drove a relative there, a freshly minted lieutenant, late on the night before she flew to Europe for her first assignment and the first real job of her life. She was young, tense, bursting with Air Force protocols. Who could blame her for taking the rule book as the final authority? By happenstance, I took a civilian highway outside the eastern perimeter of the base when her billet was on the western side. Irritated, I checked a map and discovered to my disgust that the only public connection to the right road on the far side of the base where the motel sat was miles away. It was late. I was tired. To make matters worse, I knew this prim young lady would need to be sharp in the morning, so guilt prodded me. There was just one way to avoid the long detour, and that was to take the military road through the center of the base, leading directly to where we wanted to be. Well, then, we would take it. But the lieutenant was aghast. It was not possible. I wasn't authorized, had no tag, no permit, had no rank. No, no, not permitted. Listen to me, the young woman demanded. Security is maniacal on SAC bases. We'll have to take the long way around. What she said was perfectly reasonable, but quite wrong. One of the genuine advantages of living as long as I have is that you eventually come to see the gaps between man-made systems and human reality. Even in a perfect system, functions must be assigned to people, and people find a way to sabotage their system functions even if they don't want to. Systems violate some profound inner equilibrium. Call it the soul, if you like. Systems are inhuman. People are not. On the principle, nothing ventured, nothing gained, I drove toward the guard post sitting astride the traverse road, all the while listening to my passenger. Increasingly nervous, shrilly informing me that there was no way I would be allowed to pass. And don't play games, she further told me ominously. MPs have instructions to shoot people acting suspiciously. We pulled up to the guard booth. No one was in sight, so I proceeded down the transverse like a justified sinner, smiling. But the lieutenant beside me was so agitated, I stopped and backed up quite a long way to the lighted hut again and blew the horn. This time a guard emerged, his tie askew, lipstick all over his face. I shouted out the window, "Okay if I drive through the motel? The lieutenant here is leaving for Germany tomorrow. I'd like to get her to bed." "Sure, go ahead." He waved and went back to whatever paramilitary pursuit he was engaged in, repopulating the world or whatever. The temptation to gloat over my officious kinswoman was strong, but I fought it down in light of her tender age. Just outside the far gate across the base was the ghastly two-story cinder block motel, a type favored by military personnel in transit, where a reservation waited in the young woman's name. As we pulled into the front parking lot, a terrible sight greeted my young relative, a sight that reminded me of nothing so much as Monongahela on a bad Saturday night around New Year's Eve. At least 24 men, some half in uniform, some bare-chested and bloody, were fist-fighting all over the first-floor walkway and on the little balcony that paralleled the second floor. Dozens more watched, hooting and howling, beer cans in hand. Grunts and the sounds of fists smacking heads and bodies filled the air. They were all enlisted men, apparently indifferent to official disapproval, for all the world as if they had been Chechens or Hmong instead of obedient American soldiers. At first, I couldn't believe my eyes. The combat clearly had been raging for a while, but no Air Force or local police had moved to stop it. Suddenly, to my dismay, from the new officer's uniform beside me with a girl inside came something like these words. "I'll stop this. Let me out of the car. When they see an officer's uniform, they'll take off running." "Don't do it," I begged. "They should take off running. But what if they don't? What if that pack of fighting drunks goes for you because they like to fight and think it's none of your business? Why don't we just find another place for you to sleep? You've got a plane to Germany in the morning. Let's keep our eye on the ball." Driving to another motel, I said cautiously, "You know, what they write in rule books and how things really work are never the same. We all learn that as we get older." She was too angry to hear, I think. It's fairly clear to me by now that we engage in our endless foreign adventures, launching military forces against tiny islands like Grenada, or tiny nations like Panama, bombing the vast deserts of Iraq, a country of 22 million people, or engage in our reckless social adventures too, patenting human genes, forcing kids to be dumb, because our leadership classes are worn out from the long strain of organizing everything over the centuries. Our leadership has degenerated dramatically, just as British leadership did after Ladysmith, Kimberley, and Mafeking. Recently, I read of an American newsman who walked unchallenged into a nuclear weapons storage facility near Moscow, watched over by a single guard without a weapon. It tends to make me skeptical about any orderly scientific future. Is it possible that those who sit atop the social bell curve represent the worst of evolution's products, not its best? Have the fools among us, who just don't get it, risen up and taken command? Think of the valiant symbols of our time. Coca-Cola, the Marlboro Man, disposable diapers, disposable children, Dolly the cloned sheep, Verdun, Auschwitz, Hiroshima, the national highway system, My Lai, fiat money, the space program, Chernobyl, Waco, the highway of death, welfare, Bhopal, hordes of homeless, psychopathic kids filling the corridors of schools, put out of sight and mind until their morale deteriorated. Think of Princess Di and the Ponzi scheme we call Social Security. The missile attack on Sudan, the naval blockade of Haiti. The naval blockade of Haiti? Is any of this real? People who walk the dogs and kiss the grandchildren are all so tired of grandiose schemes and restless utopians, I doubt if too many would really care if the planet exploded tomorrow. Think of the never-ending stream of manufactured crises like the invasion of Panama or the cremation of Iraq, principal products of a spent leadership trying to buy itself time while the grail search for a destiny worth having goes on in laboratories and conference rooms instead of in homes and villages where it belongs. Did the people who arranged this sorry soap opera ever take note how green the world really is? How worthwhile the minds and hearts of average men and women? How particular the hue of each blade of grass? It's the terrible idleness of the social engineering classes that drives them mad, I think. They have nothing worthwhile to do, so they do us. I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Tanya Abey was a 17-year-old New York City school dropout bicycle messenger in 1987 when she decided to become the first American woman to sail around the world alone. She had a 26-foot boat and no nautical tradition when she set out. She admits to cheating on her Coast Guard navigation exam. In a hurricane off Bermuda, generator gone, her life in peril. She taught herself navigation in a hurry by flashlight and made port. 2 years later, her record-making circuit of planet Earth was complete. A recent analysis of American diet by the Harvard School of Public Health disclosed the curious fact that the extremely poor eat healthier diets than upper-middle-class Americans. If that doesn't break you up, consider the lesson of the 232-year-old aristocratic merchant bank of Barings, destroyed in the wink of an eye through the wild speculations of an executive who turned out to have been the son of a plasterer bereft of any college degree. The poor man's schemes were too impenetrable for company management to understand, but they needed his vitality badly, so they were afraid to challenge his decisions. They never dared ask any basic questions, said the young felon who gambled away $1.3 billion on parlays so fanciful you might think only a rube would attempt them. They were afraid of looking stupid, about not understanding futures and options. They knew nothing at all. Quis custodiet, ipsios custodes. And that is, who takes care of the caretakers, in Latin. You can't help but smile at the justice of it. Having procured a Leviathan state finally, its architects and their children seem certain to be flattered by it, too, soon after the rest of us become linoleum. No walled or gated compound is safe from the whirring systems rationalizing everything, squeezing children of social engineers just as readily as yours or mine. They knew nothing, said the criminal, nothing. That's the feeling I frequently got while tracking the leaders of American schooling at every stage of the game, while they mutilated their own lives as fantastically as they did the lives of others. All that sneaking, scheming, plotting, lying, it ruined the grand designers as it ruined their victims. The big schoolhouse testifies more to the folly of human arrogance, what the Greeks called hubris. Our leaders, one after another, have been childish men. So many of the builders of school were churchmen or the sons of churchmen. We need to grasp the irony that they ruined the churches as well, the official churches anyway. That probably explains the mighty religious hunger loose in the land as I write, having slipped the bonds of establishment churches as it became clear those vassal bodies were only subsystems of something quite unholy. The drive to contemplate things beyond the reach of technology or accountants is far from extinct, as the social engineers thought it was going to be. Such an important part of the mystery of coal nation schooling is locked up in the assassination of religion and the attempted conversion of its principles of faith into serviceable secular wisdom and 12-step programs, that we will never understand our failure with schools if we become impatient when religion is discussed, because school is the civil religion meant to replace faith. American Protestantism, once our national genius, left its pulpit behind, began to barter and trade in the marketplace, refashioning God and gospel to sustain a social service vision of life. In so doing, it ruined itself while betraying us all, Protestants and non-Protestants alike. A legacy of this is the fiefdom of Hawaii, saddest American territory of all, an occupied nation we pretend is an American state, its land area and economy owned to an astonishing degree by the descendants of a few missionary families, managed by government agencies. The original population has been wiped away. Under the veneer of a vacation paradise, which wears thin almost at once, one finds the saddest congregations on earth, parishioners held prisoner by barren ministers without any rejuvenating sermons to preach. Hawaiian society is the Chautauqua forced schooling aims toward. that privileges of leadership shouldn't rest on the shaky foundation of wealth, property, and armed guards, but on the allegiance, respect, and love of those led. Leadership involves providing some purpose for getting out of bed in the morning, some reason to lay about with the claymore or drop seeds in the dirt. Wealth is a fair trade to grant leaders in exchange for a purpose, but the leader's end of the bargain must be kept. In the United States, the pledge has been broken and the break flaunted for an entire century through the mass schooling institution. Here is the crux of the dilemma. Modern schooling has no lasting value to exchange for the spectacular chunk of living time it wastes or the possibilities it destroys. The kids know it, their parents know it, you know it, I know it, and the folks who administer the medicine know it. School is a fool's bargain. We are fools for accepting its dry beans in exchange for our children. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In 1966, I taught the novel Moby Dick, film theory, and versification to a 13-year-old kid named Roland Lagiardi Laura at JHS 44 in Manhattan. Roland was memorable in many ways, but two I remember best were him reeking of garlic at 9 in the morning every morning, and his determination never to work at a job but to be a poet. Before he had even graduated from college, both his parents died, leaving him nearly penniless. Forced to become completely self-supporting, he still remained focused on poetry, and a little over a decade later, while living on a shoestring, organized a mobile band of poet terrorists who raced around the state in a candy-striped truck, delivering poetry spontaneously in bars and on street corners. Shortly afterwards, while living in a building without secure stairs or an intact roof, he flew to Nicaragua, where poetry is the national sport, and convinced the government to allow him to make a poetry documentary. When I advanced him $50 out of the 300 grand he would need, I told him he was nuts. But somehow he raised the money, made the film, and won 9 international film awards. Meanwhile, he'd learned to support himself doing carpentry and odd jobs, the oddest of which was to help rehabilitate a shambles of a building near Hell's Angels headquarters on Manhattan's Lower East Side and convert it into a poetry nightclub, where he would later become the director and an impresario. Who would go to a poetry nightclub? It turns out a lot of people. And as the New Yorican Poets Cafe expanded to include Roland's unique creation, a live reading of original film scripts using top professional actors, I saw the unfolding of a life that's touched the lives of thousands of people, helping foster their talent, not a corporate agenda. Rooted in his local community, full of distinction, thoroughly scholarly, Roland's career as a poet and critically acclaimed filmmaker simply would not have been possible or even foreseeable as a school-to-work program. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Of course, when you cheat people good, you start to worry about your victims getting even. David Gordon's 1996 book, Fat and Mean, The Corporate Squeeze of Working Americans and the Myth of Managerial Downsizing, catches the spirit of the national guilty conscience in this way. Quote, can't trust your workers when left to their own devices? Peer over their shoulders. Watch behind their backs. Record their movements. Monitor them. Supervise them. Boss them. Above all else, don't leave them alone. As one recent study observed, American companies tend fundamentally to mistrust workers, whether they are salaried employees or blue-collar workers, close quote. And American schools tend fundamentally to mistrust students. One way to deal with danger from the middle and bottom of the evolutionary order is to buy off the people's natural leaders. Instead of killing Zapata, smart money deals Zapata in for his share. We've seen this principle as it is downloaded into the gifted and talented classrooms from the lofty abstractions of Peretta and Mosca. Now it's time to regard those defanged, gifted children grown up, waiting at the trough like the others. What do they, in their turn, have to teach anyone? David Gordon says 13% of U.S. non-farm workers are managerial and administrative. That's one boss for every 7.5 workers. And the percentage of non-teaching school personnel is twice that. Compare those numbers to a manager-worker ratio of 4.2% in Japan, 3.9% in Germany, 2.6% in Sweden. Since 1947, when the employment hierarchy egg laid during the American Civil War finally hatched after incubating for a century, the number of managers and supervisors in America has exploded 360%, if only titled ones are counted, and at least twice that if de facto administrators, like teachers without teaching programs, are added in. All this entails a massive income shift from men and women who produce things to managers and supervisors who do not. What does this add up to in human terms? Well, for one thing, if our managerial burden was held to the Japanese ratio, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 million production-level jobs could be paid for. That would mean the end of unemployment, totally. An economy arranged as ours could not tolerate such a condition, I understand. Let me disabuse you next of any silly notion the pain of downsizing is being spread out by an even-handed political management, touching comfortable and hard-pressed alike. While it is true, as James Fallow says, that the media paid disproportionate attention to downsizing toward the top rungs of the occupational hierarchy, the sobering facts are these. From 1991 to 1996, the percentage of managers among non-farm employees rose about 12%. For each fat cat kicked off the gravy train, 1.12 new ones climbed aboard. All of this is evidence, not of generosity, I think, but of a growing fear of ordinary people. Is all this just more of the same scare talk you've heard until you're sick of it? I don't know. What do you make of these figures? From 1790 until 1930, America incarcerated 50 people for every 100,000 in the population. For 140 years, the ratio held steady. Then suddenly the figure doubled between 1930 and 1940. The Depression, you say? Maybe, but there had been depressions before, and anyway, by 1960 it doubled again to 200 per 100,000. The shock of World War II could have caused that, but there had been wars before. Between 1960 and 1970, the figure jogged higher once again to 300 per 100,000, and 400 per 100,000 by 1980, and near 500 per 100,000, where it hovers at the new century's beginning. Has this escalation anything to do in a family way with the odd remark attributed by a national magazine to Marine Major Craig Tucker of Fort Leavenworth's Battle Command training program that a time may come when the military may have to go domestic? Close quote. I guess that's what he was taught at Fort Leavenworth. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. How would pedagogical theory explain Wendy Ziegler, my prize student out of Roland's class at 13, but fairly anonymous, as most of us are ever after? Springing into action in her fifth decade, converting her flat in the funky Bernal Heights section of San Francisco to the day school code through her own labor, and suddenly opening a magnificently creative place for kids, 2.5 to 6, called Wendy Z's Room to Grow, which did land office business from the first. How would it explain Amy Halpern devoting a substantial chunk of her life to fine-tuning a personal film falling lessons, which he knew in advance would never earn a penny and might not even be shown. What drives an artist like Amy to strive for a non-commercial masterpiece? We have no business imposing a simplistic template on the human spirit that makes a mockery of Smith's brilliant free market. When I get most gloomy about this, I summon up a picture of a noble British general with powdered hair and pipe clay leggings sitting astride a white stallion directing troop movements across the Green River Monongahela, his brilliant columns all in red stretching far behind him. "The most magnificent sight I ever saw," said George Washington many years later when he remembered it. Who could blame all those ordinary men for betting their lives on an invincible military machine, all glittering and disciplined? All they had to do was ride down naked American savages from the Stone Age. All they had to do was take their orders and obey them. General Braddock and British tradition dictated common soldiers should be treated like dumb children, as a tough, unsentimental shepherd treats sheep. It wasn't even very hard to imagine these lowly soldiers so well gotten up, feeling proud to submerge their little destinies in the awesome collective will of the British Empire. But as things turned out, a day of reckoning was at hand for the Empire. Exposed in full pretension, the collapse of the British expedition under Braddock sent a shock of wild surmise through the minds of other common men in the colonies and their leaders. If Braddock didn't know what he was doing, is it possible German King George back in London could be taken, too? An important counter-revolutionary event with a bearing on the changes going on in our schools happened quietly not so long ago, just a stone's throw from where Braddock fell. Bill Sarin tells of it in his book Homestead. By 1988, the Monongahela Valley had been stripped bare of its mines and mills by Pittsburgh financial interests and their hired experts, who had no place in profit-loss equations for people and communities, whatever rhetoric said to the contrary. As a consequence, Monongahela, Charleroi, Denora, Homestead, Manesson, all were dying. Places that had been on fire once had possessed vibrancy and life. Now they were falling into the aimless emptiness of the unemployed after a century as the world's steelmakers. Not idle of their own choice, not even unproductive, the mills still made a profit, yet not a profit large enough to please important financial interests. In the bleak winter of 1988, Charles of the Royal Blood came to visit Steel Valley High in Homestead, nominally to talk about turning dead steel mills into arboretums. Why Charles? He was the world's leading architecture buff, so why not? His Highness' fleet of 24 Chinese red Jaguars crossed the Homestead High Bridge only minutes from the spot where Braddock died on the Monongahela. Perhaps the prince had been informed of this. Perhaps he was making a statement for history. In a motorcade of scarlet, he roared over the bridge. Residents who had gathered to wave at the prince and his entourage saw only a whir of scarlet as he whizzed into Homestead. Charles was too preoccupied with his own agenda to wave back at the offspring of Europe's industrial proletariat thrice removed. Victory, as always, comes to those who abide. We had only one Washington, one Jackson, only one Lincoln to lead us against the imperial mind. After they were gone, only the people remembered what America was about. Sarin writes, a handful of activist ministers gathered along Charles Way holding tomatoes, and Police Chief Kelly assumed, not without reason, that they were going to throw them at the prince. Or in Monongahela vernacular, tomato him. The motive for this bad hospitality was a growing anger at the text of the prince's speech to a group of architects assembled in Pittsburgh for a Remaking Cities conference. The conference had been co-sponsored by the Royal Institute of British Architects. Andrew Carnegie's dream of reuniting with a mother country was coming true in the very town most associated with Carnegie's name. The British have a grand sense of history, they do. The assembled architects had been studying the settlements of my valley and recommending replacement uses for its mills. They proposed conversion of empty steel plants into exhibition halls for flower shows. At the public hearing, valley residents shouted, "We don't want flowers, we want jobs, we want the valley back." This was the steel center of the world. Prince Charles spoke to the crowd as one might speak to children, just as he might have spoken had Braddock won and the revolution never taken place. The upshot was a grand coalition of elites reformed to revitalize the valley. I see a parallel in the formation of the New American Schools Committee, whose 18 members counted 15 corporate CEOs, including the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company's descendant form, RJR Nabisco, announcing revitalization of our schools. The effort to save Homestead looked like this through the eyes of New York Times labor reporter Bill Sarin. Quote, "In its tragedy, Homestead became fashionable. Homestead was the rage. There were study groups and committees, historical exhibits, film proposals, lectures, brown bag lunches, dinners, economic analyses, historical surveys, oral histories, a case study of disinvestment and redevelopment plans in the Monongahela Valley done by the Harvard Business School, architects, city planners, historians, economists, anthropologists, sociologists, social workers, foundation experts, all these and others became involved." Close quote. An echo of the great transformational days when we got factory schooling, the same buzz and hubbub, fashionable people with their shirt sleeves metaphorically rolled up. Then suddenly the attention was over. All of the paraphernalia of concern resulted in, quote, "little effort on Homestead or the other steel towns." There never was a plan to redevelop Homestead. The goal had been to ensure that there were no more protests like the ones earlier in the decade. If there was a master plan, it was death and highways. Homestead would be gone. A highway through the valley would eliminate even the houses, perhaps obliterate Homestead and the other steel towns. One more thing, the training programs, they were bullshit. Close quote. So here we are. In order to clean the social canvas, a reduction in the maximum levels of maturity to be allowed grown men and women has been ordered from somewhere. We are to be made and kept as nervous, whining adolescents. This is a job best begun and ended while we are little children, hence the kind of schools we have. A governor put on our growth, through which we are denied the understandings needed to escape childhood. Don't blame schools. Schools only follow orders. Schoolmen are as grateful as grenadiers to wear a pretty paycheck and be part of Braddock's invincible army. Theirs is not to reason why, if they know what's good for them. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. John Taylor Gatto spent 30 years as a school teacher in New York City, which caused him to conclude that schooling was harming the intellectual development of children. This book, 10 Years in the Making, was his attempt to understand how this situation came about. You can download this entire elaborately footnoted and well-researched book for free online at John Taylor Gatto's website, johntaylorgatto.com. And you can download this show and all previous episodes as MP3s at unwelcomeguests.org. We'll continue with part 3 of The Trap and the conclusion of this chapter next week. Thank you for listening. They'll take your money.